It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Participation in youth sports is on the decline nationwide. In Milwaukee, some studies point to barriers for inner-city youth. But one little league program in the city with a rich history is seeing continued success. Evan Casey has this report.
All right. It's a busy day here at the Beckham Stapleton Little League in Milwaukee. Players are trying out for spots on the roster at the facility's indoor practice space.
Last one, get it.
That's the voice of Tawina Duncan, a coach for the league. As a kid, Duncan would help operate the scoreboard during games. Now, she gives up many of her weeknights to help volunteer. She says it's a positive way to help keep kids off the streets in the summer.
But this is something positive to get them on a straight and narrow path. It teaches them teamwork. It teaches them camaraderie. It teaches them responsibility. It teaches them that you don't have to be perfect to be successful.
The Little League was founded in 1964 by a former player for the Negro Leagues. And even today, most of its players are black. It began with just four teams. Now, over 300 children, ages 4 to 16, play against each other. Duncan's son Matthew is one of those players. He started playing baseball when he was just 5 years old.
I was screwing up, but I didn't give up and I kept trying. And now, a couple years later, I'm 12 years old, won the championship game, and going on to the juniors now.
Nationally, participation in youth sports has been declining in recent years. A report from the Milwaukee Youth Sports Alliance found cost and safety concerns can keep low-income youth from playing in the league. It also found that some inner-city schools have gotten rid of their sports programs altogether. Quentin Prince played for the league as a child and is the current executive director of the Alliance. He says youth sports should be for everyone.
And so if we can elevate youth sports, give them an outlet, and allow them the opportunity to be engaged in this activity, but then also all of the benefits that come from it, you know, we could change the trajectory of so many lives in a positive way.
But it's not easy. In 2020, the Wisconsin Policy Forum found a lack of funding was the biggest challenge for youth sports organizations in the city. Many programs in Milwaukee, including the Beckham Stapleton Little League, rely on private donations and fundraising. But Prince believes the community can come together to fix the issue.
And that means the youth sports organizations working with corporate foundations, working with the school system, across the board, we need just a network of partnerships where people are coming together to support this effort.
Meanwhile, the Beckham Stapleton Little League is defying the trend. It's seen what its president Jim Bray calls, quote, an explosion of players in recent years. That's largely because they now have a new softball program for girls. Bray says he spends much of his time talking to potential sponsors, since some players need help buying gloves and cleats.
Our statement is that anybody who registers will play, and we will work out, get sponsors, do whatever we can.
Since its start, coaches and volunteers with the Little League have mentored over 25,000 youth in Milwaukee. Alumni include police officers, teachers, and lawmakers. Devin Harris, a former NBA player for the Dallas Mavericks, played in the league in the 1990s. Back at league tryouts, Matthew Duncan says he has high hopes for his future baseball career.
I plan on making it to the professionals, and once I'm out of there, I plan to become a brain surgeon.
Games begin this May. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore now what is trending on restaurant menus, from cherry blossom flavoring to cheese. A restaurant and consulting firm, they track about 40,000 menu items at major chains, and they have insights on our evolving tastes. So call in with your questions, your thoughts, anytime on food trends, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Costio is a food trendologist and associate director at the market research firm Data Central. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, it's fitting that we begin with cheese. So I'm going to tee things up here. Wisconsin making more than a quarter of our country's cheese, more than any other state. And here comes your report saying, you know, cheese is the top ingredient being added to restaurant menus. So how are restaurants using our beloved cheese in new ways?
Sure, absolutely. And it has been the top growing ingredient on major chain menus for quite a while now. We actually call cheese a crave-worthy ingredient. One of the things that we do with our clients when we're testing a new menu item is we'll add ingredients that we consider to be crave-worthy because they really increase crave scores. And cheese is one of the top ones. So like crunchy is a really good one, but cheese is way up there. And some of the things that we're seeing on menus when it comes to cheese are actually really related to the Wisconsin food scene. So beer cheese is way up on menus. It's actually up 35% on menus. Cheese curds up, you know, I know they're found all over the menu in Wisconsin, but now they're way up nationally, up 31% on menus. So we definitely see some of those Wisconsin, you know, cheese products and flavors. The other thing we definitely see is a lot of kind of Latin and Hispanic inspired cheeses. So the cotijas and the queso blancos and things like that growing.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, crave-worthy. I'm kind of trying out new taglines here. Wisconsin, crave-worthy. I don't know if that really hits home. But I wonder if cheese, you know, I hate to use the word fill ingredient, but I also wonder if it's like it's a reliable ingredient in that it gives you the fats and just, you know, it gives you that that home taste. If what else is going on with cheese that it makes it such a staple ingredient?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is. You know, I think it's such a classic ingredient, something that we all grew up with. It's so comforting. And certainly during the pandemic, we, you know, really reached for those comforting foods. I think it performs so well across such a wide variety of applications. So you can use it in a sauce, you know, you can use it in a sandwich, you use it on pizza. So you use it in so many of those, you know, ingredients and dishes that you see so often on menus. And the other thing is a lot of cheeses really are shelf stable. And, you know, chefs right now are not trying to put, you know, a really perishable ingredients back of house just because prices are so high. They don't want things to go bad. So at least cheese is that dairy product that you can, you know, kind of feel a little bit safer purchasing, and it's not going to go bad quite as quickly as like a milk or another dairy product.
And you also have to look for those ingredients that are supply chain stable, that there's a steady flow of cheese, that it's a reliable product and you won't have disruptions where you say, uh-oh, you know, now how do we replace this?
Absolutely, definitely. Yeah, I mean, there were, you know, during the pandemic, we saw chicken was the number one option that so many operators couldn't get a hold of. So they were replacing chicken left and right, which is kind of crazy. Chicken is, you know, used on so many menus.
Right.
But cheese, we didn't see the same thing. Cheese has really held steady on menus.
And you say Mexican-style cuisine is more popular among younger generations, whereas Italian was previously the top choice for decades. Why are food preferences changing?
Yeah, it's an interesting study that we did last year where Italian cuisine has been America's favorite cuisine for decades now. And it still is if you look at the average overall consumers. But we looked last year at different generations and started to break down generation by generation what they liked. And we started to see that millennials were actually the first generation, and that's the generation I'm a part of, that preferred Mexican cuisine over Italian cuisine, and then Chinese cuisine was in third place. And then when you look at Gen Z, it's actually Mexican cuisine is on top, Chinese just under that, and then Italian to third place. So you can really see, you know, how things are changing in the country.
Let's step back just for a moment for you to explain how you do this work. How do you collect these menu items and run them through, you know, your processes to understand what is happening with menus?
Yeah, so we have a team that actually does it. They're constantly looking online for as many, you know, menus as they can find. They're calling operators across the country to get those menus. You know, we're checking for accuracy, and it's all pegged to the census. So we want to make sure that our menu database looks like the American, you know, restaurant landscape. So it's just kind of a constant team that's always out there pulling all of this. And then we have, you know, data analysts at the company, you know, who are constantly breaking down the data, trying to figure out what's going on, you know, trying to figure out what the trend story is in the American food landscape.
Has inflation been a big disruptor to what you're seeing on menus and the costs, prices?
Huge disruptor, absolutely. So at the beginning of the year, we asked operators, you know, restaurant operators, what's your number one concern as you head into 2023? And 90% of operators said high costs and inflation were their top concern. And you so rarely see, you know, such agreement between operators in the industry. And I think, you know, when you look at, you know, the number of operators who said COVID was their number one concern, it's dropped down to 10%. So you can see just how things have changed so much for the operator and, you know, what their big pain points are right now.
Oh, that's interesting. Mike Costio with the market research firm tracking the popularity of menu items and ingredients. What diners are in the mood to eat? Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn what new ingredients and flavors are making their way into restaurant menus and how cheese is rising up as the most common new ingredient, but has been there all along. It's kind of like that blue chip stock, if you will, of dependable ingredients, great reputation. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Mike Costio, trendologist at the market research firm Data Essential, analyzing menus. Mike, here's an interesting thing that you checked into. Wisconsin has more bars than nearly any other state that we can understand. Florida has the most Cuban-style restaurants, barbecue most common in southern states, yes. What regional preferences in dining are the most surprising?
Ooh, good question. I think just how they're, you know, constantly changing and, you know, the regional preferences, both within the regions themselves and how those kind of manifest nationally. So a really good example, I think, is, you know, in the Northeast, you know, some of those seafood flavors that you had only seen, you know, for a long time in the Northeast, all of a sudden starting to appear on, you know, menus across the country. The great example of that being, you know, some of those spicy flavors. I don't want to use like a brand name, but, you know, you see some of those kind of spicier profiles used in seafood dishes now, you know, manifesting more nationally. The big one certainly was Nashville Hot. So, you know, Nashville Hot for the longest time was, you know, mainly seen on Nashville menus. And then, you know, we started to see it grow on chicken sandwiches and, you know, start to show up in chain menus. And now Nashville Hot is, you know, kind of, if you're going to put a spicy flavor on the menu, that's probably one that, you know, you're going to look at, if not, you know, actually utilize on the menu. So it's always so interesting to see those regional flavors that make it national.
It seems also chicken sandwiches are having a moment going in so many different directions.
Oh my gosh, the chicken sandwich trend, you know, we constantly think, you know, is there any more, you know, room to innovate within chicken sandwiches? Is there anything that, you know, operators can do to keep it exciting? And yet it hasn't plateaued yet. We still see, you know, a number of chains introducing really interesting chicken sandwiches to the menu.
Let's take a call. Patty in Eau Claire. Patty, hi, what would you like to bring up?
I'm just curious if they are seeing any trends in people purchasing or buying meals made of Wagyu. It's a Wagyu beef. It's a high-quality beef with healthy omega fats. It's a little bit expensive, but my husband and I, we actually raise Wagyu beef, and just kind of curious if you're seeing any trends that way.
Patty, thank you so much. Mike, Wagyu beef.
Yeah, great question. Absolutely. Wagyu beef is way up, both on menus and on the consumer side. We've seen a lot of move to premiumization and, you know, consumers really understanding that, you know, premium proteins are maybe a little bit better for you, you know, maybe at the end of the day are going to give you a better taste experience. So we've absolutely seen, you know, Wagyu growing. The number of supermarkets across the country that now carry Wagyu, I think Costco often has it, you know, has increased so much. So our access, you know, is so much higher as well. So yeah, no, definitely. Good question.
Little prickly one on this one. You found that there are communities that are least aware of food trends. Wausau, Wisconsin. Wisconsin topping the list. And so I know we're naturally going to bristle a little, get a little defensive. But what did you make of these least aware food trend cities?
Yeah, and you know, to just kind of preface it, I did not work on this particular research report. So, you know, if we do anger anybody, don't come after me. You know, I can send you the names of my colleagues who worked on this report. But so one of the things that we're constantly asked is, you know, what are the most trend forward places in the country? And it's whether, you know, we're trying to identify trends and, you know, which cities we should look at, or maybe a client wants to, you know, do an immersion tour and go, you know, see the trends on the ground in the city. And so we came up with a few metrics where we could kind of figure out, you know, what those most trend forward cities were. One of them was, you know, how many different types of cuisines do you have to taste in that city to get to 90% of the dining environment? So in a city like Miami, which actually is the high score in this metric, you actually have to taste something like 23, 24 different cuisines before you've kind of exhausted, you know, the Miami restaurant scene. And so if you look on the other side of that, we looked at, you know, which city, and it's major cities, so you had to have somewhat of a larger population. You know, you had to kind of get through the least number of different, you know, types of cuisines. And it was Wausau, Wisconsin actually came out as number one.
Mm-hmm. Rockford, Illinois in the mix as well, I should add. But, you know, when they hear that about the a city that's called out in such a way, not with it perhaps on the latest in food, what does that tell people? What is the opportunity?
You know, I mean, on the one hand, I think, you know, yeah, we bristle at it immediately, you know, if we lived there. But one, I think, you know, what that means today is very different from what it would have meant, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago. You still have to try 11 different cuisines to kind of get through all of the dining environment in Wausau, which is a good amount, you know, for a smaller town or city. You know, that's still a good number of, you know, cuisines you have to get through. The other thing, too, is we just have so much more access to foods and cuisines and different flavors, no matter where we are today. So, you know, we can order things online. You know, we don't necessarily stay in our towns. We can travel wherever we are. So, you know, wherever you are, even if it's, you know, a town that maybe doesn't have a huge dining scene with lots of different options, there's still so many opportunities to try, you know, a lot of different interesting novel foods and flavors out there.
Talking about restaurant trends with a trendologist, Mike Costio from the market research firm Data Essential. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Mike, what have been the influence of food trucks in, you know, in affecting the trajectory of dining trends?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm actually about to work on a food truck project just because, you know, when I started at the company, which was a decade ago, you know, food trucks were everywhere. You know, there were definitely cities in the United States that had great food truck scenes. But, you know, we finally started to see that grow in other cities throughout the country. And then we kind of saw it plateau and even decline a little bit. And then the pandemic actually brought them back. You know, we saw a number of operators that were looking for operations that allowed them to serve food outside. We saw, you know, chefs who maybe, you know, didn't have the jobs that they used to have were looking for, you know, maybe that startup opportunity, and they, you know, launched a food truck. So I actually think, you know, post-COVID, we're going to see kind of a flourishing of new food trucks across the country.
And their mobility, too, moving to places where people can be, not a fixed site restaurant, that must be an advantage.
Absolutely, definitely. Particularly when you consider, you know, the food scene in the country now, we love our, you know, food festivals and food-centric festivals. And, you know, so many businesses want to have really cool food experiences, you know, tied to their business. So, you know, if you run a mall now, you run a supermarket now, if you run a healthcare center now, you know, you can call in one of those food trucks to be in the parking lot. That gives you a little bit of that food cachet.
Let's quick get in a call here. Tony in Sturgeon Bay. Tony, hi.
Good morning. I'm new to the biz. I'm 67 and never waited tables in my life, but this is a heck of a roller coaster. Our chef owner, I'm a waiter up in Sturgeon Bay, probably the best Italian restaurant in the county. And our chef owner just put mussels, sauteed Nova Scotia fresh mussels, on the menu as an appetizer, and they just sold out immediately, and I think people are looking for some different taste options. And what better place than an Italian restaurant to get those great flavors.
Tony, thank you. Mussels flying there, Mike. What do you make of that?
Absolutely. I mean, mussels, one super cost-effective option to put on the menu, so really key right now. The other thing, too, is, you know, seafood in general scores really well with consumers on a number of metrics. They think it's, you know, a pretty premium option, and it's a pretty healthy option. So, you know, those are two kind of important things when you're deciding what to eat. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
Mike, thank you for joining us.
Ah, thank you. It was great being on.
Mike Castillo is a trendologist and associate director at Data Essential in Chicago. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story for Earth Day, which is Saturday.
Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson helped organize the first Earth Day back in 1970 after growing concerns for the environment. Since then, it's been a day to celebrate our natural resources while also drawing attention to increasing threats to them. Madison writer Araceli Esparza wanted to take this Earth Day to do her own reflecting on Wisconsin's environment through poetry.
In a pink house in a small art studio. I liked these colors when I was a child, Mama said. Why, Rosita asked. Because they remind me of the sky, Mama answered. Tap, tap, her brush went, dotting many colors in the sky until we only saw one color, the light of day. That color was like the sun, like freshly picked corn. And there was a red color like the northern cranberries. Mama painted green lettuce-colored prairies and pointed trees. These colors together became a forest. In a swoop, she turns a trail into one color, snow. Like cows laughing in the snow, she paints the sky a blue-black where you can see every star, and she adds clouds because the nights are cold near the lakes. It looks like home, Rosita says. Pues, it does, Mama says. And she painted until the horizon met the dairy farms and the rolling hills of our home, the heartland.
Araceli Esparza is a writer who lives in Madison. After recording her poem, I asked Araceli what inspired her to write Earth Day in the Heartland.
What inspired me to write this poem was about Earth Day. I have seen so many of our youth on a global scale bringing attention to the environment and the protection thereof. And I wanted to use my platform to bring attention to this day and how we all care about the earth. I think sometimes there's a misconception that only certain people who go hiking or people who are going boating or people who only eat at a co-op can participate in conservation of our planet. And that's just not true.
I love that you illustrate the love of the earth and the love of the environment and the celebration of Earth Day through this like really beautiful moment between a mother and her daughter.
Yeah, and painting, right?
And painting.
Like, how random.
I know. Why was the direction that you wanted to take?
I mean, I'm not a painter either, mind you. I'm a painter of words, perhaps. But these are all things that I felt like when I think about the landscape of Wisconsin and what ties us, what keeps our heart tethered here, are the rolling hills, the dairy farms, and just like going to some prairie for the corn fest, having everything cranberry-esque, like you're going to run across some cranberries if you're here. You're going to run across lettuce-colored prairies. The greenness of this environment of our Dane County, of like the state of Wisconsin, all of that is just that this green that I have introduced other people from other parts of the United States, and they're always amazed at like how green it is. And pointy trees.
evergreens, right? They're just really a part of our landscape, and I wanted to pay homage to that.
At the end, you know, she painted until the horizon met the dairy farms and the rolling hills of our home. It's like, this is our home. This is our new home. And we have all our responsibility to keep it safe and to sustain it. I feel like this is a poem that kind of, at least for the parents to know, too, that we care about you and what work you're doing. And it's hard work to impart climate awareness to our kids. But there are fun and easy ways of doing it.
Araceli Esparza is a writer who lives in Madison and is founder of Midwest Mujeres. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to PBS Wisconsin's new special from the Wisconsin Life series. It is called The Wisconsin Muslim Project, and it premieres tonight at 8. Exploring the stories of Muslims across the state at the end of Ramadan, the holiest month on the Islamic calendar. Join in by calling with your questions, your experiences. Welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly Saran is here, series producer for Wisconsin Life. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Well, when you look at our Wisconsin population as a whole, Pew Research estimates 1% identify as Muslim out of the nearly 6 million people who live here. What do you hope people learn about the Muslim community in Wisconsin?
So I hope that people kind of learn that Muslims in Wisconsin are diverse and they're an active group. What does a Muslim really look like in Wisconsin? You know, it looks like a lot of different things. And in this special, we're just meeting a few Muslims in Wisconsin who are doing amazing things. And I just want people to like meet Muslims maybe for the first time. Maybe they are Muslim. Maybe they see something within themselves. But it looks like a lot of different things in Wisconsin. And that's what we want to share.
Can you describe the settings where you take us and where you connect with the people you profiled in order to tell their story more deeply, more personally? Take us, you know, how did you take us into their lives?
Yeah, so the project really started, I think, about 2 years ago. And we worked with a committee of Muslims and non-Muslims, many United Against Hate and the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition, to identify stories of Muslim communities around Wisconsin. And so we traveled to a lot of different places to meet a lot of different Muslims to try to decide whose stories we want to tell. And it was really hard to pick who. But we were able to take our host to the Fox Valley Islamic Society in Neenah to kind of meet a growing community there that's kind of outgrown their space. They believe they're the oldest Muslim-owned community center in Northeast Wisconsin. Then we travel to Milwaukee, which is a huge Muslim population. We meet Brother Will Perry. He's on the north side of Milwaukee, kind of working at the Dawa Center. He's running a food pantry. He's running a reentry program for people who are coming out of incarceration. We go all the way to Barron, Wisconsin to meet Isaac Mohammed, who's a Somali-born city council member, then back to Madison to meet a UW law professor, then back to Milwaukee. So we really try to go around the state to meet as many kind of different Muslims as there are. And like I said, we could just go on and on. Like, there are so many Muslims kind of in Wisconsin in general, and we tried to kind of traverse the state and meet as many as we could to share their stories.
Kelly, as a Muslim woman yourself, how does that inform how you view the series, how you see the subjects?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, as a practicing Muslim, you kind of have that lead in that you're comfortable in that space. You kind of meet a lot of different Muslims, even being a Muslim. So you already know that there's kind of this wealth of storytelling within a community, and I feel very excited to kind of share it. I've met Muslims, so many, you know, in my time as being a Muslim, and it helps me kind of just approach it in a very empathetic way, to kind of understand where Muslims coming from, what are they doing within the community, and let's get out there and share that. So I think, you know, as a journalist, it's exciting to do it. But as a Muslim, it's really exciting because you've been meeting people that are within this community for a long time. And this is kind of my turn to share it.
Some people outside the Muslim faith may be reluctant to ask you questions about wearing the hijab, the women wearing a headscarf. What might you say about the hijab?
You know, a hijab is kind of a form of submission for us as Muslims. We believe that Allah is asking us to wear the hijab. So I would say, you know, it's okay to ask questions about it. It is part of our faith as well, that it's an outward facing kind of form of faith for women as well too. But it's okay to ask questions about it. It is part of our submission, and it is a part of who we are as Muslims. But it's the most outward facing, and not everybody wears hijab. So you might meet a Muslim and you don't even know they're Muslim if they're not wearing a hijab, but this is just one part of who we are.
We're going to, you mentioned Brother Will Perry. We're going to hear a little bit of this now. The Wisconsin Muslim Project visits the Islamic Dawah Center, and we hear from Brother Will Perry about the start of this weekly food pantry.
This is an opportunity for us as a religious-based organization. One of our creeds is to feed other people, regardless of who they are and where they're from. So we began the food pantry in 2007 out of my minivan at the time.
What did your team learn from talking with Brother Will?
So Brother Will Perry is a very interesting story because he used to be a firefighter as he became Muslim. And he was Muslim for a very long time. And he kind of was coming out of retirement and decided that he wanted to do something with his life that continued to be meaningful. So he became the executive director at the Dawah Center. And it's such an interesting and active community who's doing a lot. So they run this weekly food pantry, but I think they've even expanded the hours since I last talked to them as well. But it's kind of hitting all sorts of people. It's not just the Muslim community. They're kind of reaching out and helping everybody in the community. And it's interesting to hear Brother Perry talk about that because he directly links that to his faith, as that is part of his creed, is to, like he said, feed other people and take care of his community. So what does that mean? It means a food pantry. It means, you know, being there for his community. In the piece, on the gentleman in it says, like, you don't even know how much Brother Will Perry does. Like, he doesn't get the spotlight on it. And that's what I love about the series too, is that I think we meet people that maybe you wouldn't hear their story. They're kind of boots on the ground, active community members, like Brother Will, and it's an honor to really tell their stories.
They are in service and very busy in giving and doing that service.
Yeah, and that's a theme that we've seen. I was surprised because we just kept coming across, like, every story that we feature within this, even when we went to the mosque in the Fox Valley Islamic Society, they're doing so much. They're doing a lot of interfaith work. Everyone's trying to, as a Muslim, like, help other people in any way that they can. And you see that theme throughout the series, which is pretty neat.
We're getting this inside look at the new special from PBS Wisconsin, exploring the stories of Muslims across Wisconsin. The program premieres tonight at 8. Kelly Saran is the series producer for Wisconsin Life. Be part of this conversation. Call in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get a preview of the Wisconsin Muslim Project. This is a new special from Wisconsin Life, premieres on PBS Wisconsin tonight at 8. And Wisconsin Life producer Kelly Saran is here to discuss the reporting project about the stories of Muslims across the state. Call in, join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Frank in Milwaukee. Hi, Frank.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to bring up?
Yes, so I just want to add one thing to it. Even I've been in Milwaukee almost 32 years. I'm a Muslim, probably the first one that came to Milwaukee back in the early 90s. And also the Muslim community also provides a free health care for underprivileged people every Saturday. on the Sakina Center up on 8th and Layton. So I just want to add that to it, that this is one of the other, should I say, a good thing that the Muslim community is doing for the
caring for people.
For the poor, I should say.
Yes.
Yes.
Frank, thank you so much for contributing that. Kelly, go ahead.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I think the Milwaukee community is so active, so it's great to hear that. And, you know, we are celebrating the end of Ramadan here in the next couple of days, and that is also a time for us to remember to help people as well. So it's really heartening to kind of hear that story of it. And I thank you for calling that in. That's very exciting. And those are the kind of stories that we hope to tell within this series.
Let's hear another voice. This is Asifa Qureshi Lund, is the UW-Madison Law Professor, and she talks about her journey to Wisconsin, and her first impression was a positive one.
So it felt like the kind of social justice awareness issues on campus and in town was something people generally cared about, and you could talk about it. So the Wisconsin idea, when I first heard that, I was so inspired. The knowledge built at the university is a trust that is owned, really, by the people of Wisconsin. I owe something back to the people of Wisconsin.
That's a really interesting moment there, Kelly. Asifa saying the Wisconsin idea of knowledge as a community trust, also in an Islamic idea. Can you talk more about that connection?
Yeah, I think it's really, I love that she did that because one, Asifa is kind of tying her Wisconsin identity to her Muslim identity in a really meaningful way. But there it is again, that need to give back to the community. And again, that's her thread. She kind of tells the story of trying to get youth civically engaged. She makes a space for Muslims within the community, a safe place for them as well. And also kind of pushing Muslims to kind of be civically engaged, taking them to Washington, D.C. and things like that. And really, it's so interesting to me that as a Muslim, this is part of our identity. It's what she's doing. It's what she's teaching. She's a law professor, so she really gives a really insightful thought into Sharia law. And what does that mean as a Muslim? And maybe it comes off as a scary word, she says, but she kind of breaks it down to what does it mean? It's actually a way of life. It's the way that we live.
I found that moment really interesting too. Sharia, you know, she says that it has really negative connotations, fear attached to it in our country. And here, Asifa really explains how she views it differently than an outsider to the Muslim faith. And I think that is a particularly, a particularly clear moment for me that, you know, a little bit of a breakthrough there.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, too, because she's a law professor. So that is part of her study of Islamic law, is to learn about that. And she does such a great job of kind of breaking it down to show the human side of Muslims in general. And maybe people haven't heard that perspective before, but she offers that up to everyone watching. And there are little moments throughout the series that I think if you don't know anything about Islam, or you haven't met a Muslim in your life, or even if you have, and even if you are a Muslim, there's something you can learn within the series that's really impactful.
Also, the Muslim Public Service Network, I really love that idea. I mean, it was only a passing mention about welcoming people into your home and helping interns and things like that. That, too, again, that theme of service coming up.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about Muslims, too, is that you get people coming from into maybe university spaces who are Muslim, but you also have people who are converting to Islam. And so there's a really opportunity for us as Muslims to welcome people within the community. And we see that in Asifa's work as well. So she kind of makes the space to teach about Muslims in a very human way.
We're talking about the stories of Muslims in Wisconsin. Kelly Saran is with us, producer for Wisconsin Life. You can join at 800-642-1234. Let's hear another voice. One of the people featured is Isak Mohammed, works as the Somali district liaison for the Barren Area Schools in the northwestern part of the state. And here's Isak reflecting on life in the state.
We have seen integration in the community. We have seen friendship. We have seen, you know, Somalis known in northern Wisconsin. Like, they are part of the Wisconsinites, you know, they are part of this community. I was one time a refugee with no home, so stateless, but I'm proud to be a U.S. citizen. It's a great nation. It's a nation for everyone. It's a land of opportunity. You can be anything you want.
You can do anything you want. Isak, what stands out to you about his profile?
So I actually got to join Isak in Barron, and Barron's a really interesting community because they have the Jenny O factory. So that's brought in a lot of Somalis into the area, which is really interesting because you kind of have this small rural town where Somali community has really integrated himself. And Isak is the first Somali born city council member. And just following Isak in a day makes me tired. Like, he does not stop. Like, he goes to school, then he's running to city council. You know, it's just, it's amazing. And everybody in the community kind of knows him and goes to him. And it was just an honor to kind of spend time with him and share this profile because he's doing a lot of that unsung work. He's helping people, young people in the community, old people in the community. So it was really amazing just to follow him. And like I said, it was really exhausting. And I always said, like, when do you sleep? Man, because it is very, like, I just am tired watching you. But in that same way, it's like he's making this path into welcoming people into Wisconsin. And even when we went to the Fox Valley Islamic Society, I think the president there said, you know, we are Wisconsinites. Like, this is who we are. We aren't from somewhere else. This is our home. Wisconsin is our home. And I think that was really hit home in a lot of these stories as well, too, especially if communities that are coming in, whether they're refugees or immigrants, they've made Wisconsin their home. And it's really an honor. Again, I just feel honored to be able to tell these stories because, you know, these are the kind of people who are doing everyday things that make a really huge impact within our community. And it's not just the Muslim community, it's all the community. And they're really just kind of taking their identity as a Muslim and informing the work that they do.
Kelly, did anything surprise you about putting together this project? Did you have personal aha moments?
I think I did. You know, I've been a Muslim since 2009, but really exploring the Muslim communities in Wisconsin was so exciting for me because, you know, the big hubs, you know, Milwaukee, you know, Madison, of course, there would be Muslims in that area. But as you start to learn, there are Muslims throughout the state, top to bottom. Wausau has a community. Janesville has a community. This community in Barron sits, you know. And it was just exciting for me to kind of travel around the state. I got to visit a few mosques along my travels, and everywhere I felt welcome and kind of that brotherhood and sisterhood that they offer. They talk about that in the Fox Valley Islamic Society because our host Angela gets to go and into a mosque and kind of meet the community as well. But it's just, it never ceases, the brotherhood and sister. And you kind of come into a space and they're very welcoming to you. And really, they're all over. So that was kind of my aha moment, that really this community is a lot larger and more diverse than I even thought being within the community.
Oh, Kelly, thank you so much for sharing this reporting project with us. And thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. And it's part of a bigger project that PBS Wisconsin is doing as well. So I welcome you to kind of join on PBS Wisconsin's website to see the other activities. We have a photo series where you can meet even more Muslims in the community. But definitely tune in tonight at 8 p.m. on PBS Wisconsin.
Kelly Saran, series producer for Wisconsin Life, and worked on this new special called The Wisconsin Muslim Project. You can find a link to it at WPR.org/mornings as well. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.